And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
This is Phil Lernis. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And Dean Haglund is in Motor City turning off his audio alerts for emails and messages and the like. How are you, Dean?
I'm good. How are you, Phil? How much can you see today?
Well, how much is there to see, really? Because I am someone who's seen it all.
So now you can turn off the sight. That's fantastic.
You know, it's bad. It's no doubt worse than even a week ago. I've been trying to edit, as you know, part two of The Truth is out there. And in some sense, it's going very well. It's going swimmingly. I would have lost my mind if I didn't know the movie I wanted to edit, if we hadn't already kind of proven certain approaches to the material in the first film that I could then modify to convey the thematic material we're dealing with this go round. If I hadn't already done that, I would be really, really, really in a depressed, darkened state because I can't see what I'm cutting. I can hear it, though. And if I blow it up large enough, onto large enough a screen, then I can play back and watch what I've cut, just to make sure that the timing is good and everything. But it simple edits, like a simple amount of material, is taking me 5-6 times longer because of the eye strain, because of all the mistakes that I make. You know, there's in a editing system, of course, you're using so many different commands for different functions, and you know, I can't see what the commands are. I mean, I'm operating entirely on memory, and and I'm doing pretty well in that, but there is a lot of undo until you get back to whatever the wrong button was that I hit.
Wow, this sounds a lot like how Ray Charles learned the piano, actually. So
by editing a documentary?
Yeah. It's a rare. I don't know why they didn't put that in the biopic, but
I would have been good. I'm going to finally have the musical career I always wanted when my eyesight gets fixed. So there's that. We're going to talk about movies from all sorts of different angles over the next half hour, but one angle about my love of movies that has only grown is that even though I really spend the first half hour kind of painting an inner landscape of what that movie probably looks like, until my eyes adjust enough or my brain fills in the details so I imagine I know what I'm seeing. I love being in the theater because the lighting in a movie theater is pretty much what lighting should be everywhere all the time. For me to feel relaxed and at ease and comfortable. I'm Audrey Hepburn in that suspense film, for God's sakes. I need an even playing field with everybody.
Well, see, that's the thing. I agree that the lighting is much too bright these days. We can do with taking it down a couple watts, a couple shades.
Well, I think everybody probably is enduring some measure of eye strain. I really do, with all the information that we're expected to take in from such a variety of ocular sources, right?
It's true, right? Yeah.
So even with really good eyesight, I think the strain, and I never appreciated that until it became a blinding pain. But I have to be aware of it because I would like to now stave off the headaches before yes. they occur. And so I have to be aware of, oh, okay, so this is what eye strain feels like. Yeah, I've probably experienced this a lot through the years.
Right?
And
yeah, not realizing where it's coming from, how your eye muscles are taxed. Max to the max.
I don't know if we talked about this last week. I think this happened since then, and we don't really often speak about this. But, hey, congratulations on a Canadian team winning a major sports championship, Dean Haglund.
Are we talking the Stanley Cup? No, wait, that was St. Louis.
No, the Toronto Raptors. Half of Canada watched the NBA Finals at some point, 50% at some point. So it's a big deal there in Canada. And we don't really talk about the sports except usually back when the Lakers used to win, and we would talk about how downtown was on fire because
because of the rioting.
Right, the rioting. We're happy our team has won. Let's blow up some automobiles. A natural reaction. But it is refreshing that a city won the NBA title where the partying probably amounted to, I don't know, two scarves were accidentally set on fire when they dipped into a celebratory candle to blow out Make-A-Wish. I don't know. So that's how the celebrations went on in Toronto. But the Raptors win. But I don't know if you followed it, but there was something that happened. Well, two things, actually, that happened in back-to-back games where, first, in Game 5 of the Finals, the best player, and there's debate on this and pushback all the time, but just objectively speaking, if we can, of a player who, no matter the circumstances, is both available and durable and able to dominate a game, the best player in the league, Kevin Durant, had come back after a 33-day absence due to a calf strain. And 14 minutes into the game, 12 minutes into his appearance in the game, he planted and pushed off hard for the first time. And we see on camera, in close-up, on widescreens, his Achilles rupture and roll all the way up into his leg. You see the ripple and you see it roll up into his leg. So a calf strain keeps him out. He comes back. There's a catastrophic injury. His career, he will not play for a year. He will probably, as most athletes are not, he will never be the same player again. And then if that weren't enough, then the very next game, when the Warriors against the Raptors, the Warriors were mounting an unbelievable comeback, showing their championship medal after three titles in the previous 4 years. The player who was playing the best for them, Klay Thompson, who had gutted his way through a hamstring injury or a quad injury. I think it was a hamstring strain, comes back the very next game. He lands awkwardly after getting hit on a dunk attempt, and we see his ACL explode.
No!
And that is very much under the heading of fluke injury, they're saying, because it's what can you do to get when you get hit and you land awkwardly, but these things are kinetic, and
yes,
when we are unhealthy, when we are compromised, when we are nursing injuries, we are more likely, are we not, to injure something else.
That is so true. From my days in modern dance, of course, a fellow dancer had in the middle of rehearsal an Achilles snap on him and roll up like a Venetian, or no, the roller blinds.
Yeah.
Just the flappity flap flap. And the technology in the 90s, I'm going to say, was very good, as probably superior, or not superior. I mean, the today's technology in terms of replacing and putting back ligaments to bone is probably better. Well, because I know when my ACL snapped, wowzers, that was painful. And you can't really go on. You are not just crippled, you're unstable. So I had an unstable knee for a long time.
And so whole center is off. And this
your whole center is off.
So obviously the leg, but what about core muscles? What about straining your lower back? What about, I mean, there's so much that your shoulders, everything,
is compensating.
I think kinetic is the right word for all this, but it's all of a system. And this is why, you illustrated something just now, which is that, yes, medical science and modern science and modern medicine and technology has so much to offer. And so, too, does a more holistic approach. It needs to be a combination, like what we advocate in Truth Is Out There about so many topics. The challenge of modern life and the opportunity of modern life is how can you take what is beautiful and meaningful from this over here and combine it with what is beautiful and meaningful from this over here, even though those things might seem to be contradictory. Because if you can take what is beautiful and meaningful to you from seemingly disparate sources, you might be able to build something truly meaningful and wonderful from all these disparate sources. And medicine is a perfect and necessary example of that.
Absolutely. And I remember that the adhesion of my ligament back to my bone was using lactic bolts. These are screws made of cow's milk that the calcium forms right into the bone and dissolves into the entire structure. So holistically, there wasn't a metal pin in there. It was just all magically dissolving back from made from the very minerals from which it came.
The irony of that is that the Lactic Bolts was the name of the minor league basketball team I played point guard for in the early 90s.
The Lactic Bolts. That's a good one. It was worth the wait on that joke.
But I bring this up not just about sports, and although that was a big media fury about all this, that died down somewhat in the wake of Klay Thompson's injury of the ACL because people looked at it and said it's just a fluke. But again, if you're compromised, is it? If your legs are in perfect condition, if you're perfectly healthy and strong, though no athlete is at that time of the year after 10 months of nonstop play and wear and tear. But if you are, when you land awkwardly, do you not have the capability to maybe offset that awkward landing if you're not already compromised, if you're not favoring something? So I still think the question holds, but the furor in the media died down that was present after the Kevin Durant injury, because the coach, and I have no reason to believe that Coach Steve Kerr was lying about this, he was really shaken up after Kevin Durant's injury, saying the doctors kept telling us the worst that could happen is that he could re-injure the calf. He could re-aggravate the calf. They told us there was no risk of any other greater injury. And based on how he was saying that, I have no doubt that that's what he was told. But I don't understand how any doctor could ever say that unless they are absolutely ignorant to how systems of muscles and tendons and ligaments operate.
Well, here we come now to the idea of modern medicine. And that is, it is impossible now for any single person to know everything about medicine. They are technically all specialists. And when you are a specialist, you're not working holistically or thinking holistically. You are working within your realm of what you do. So if you are a muscle guy, you're not thinking bone and ligament as much. And if you are a bone specialist, you are looking strictly at structure and not so much concerned and or knowledgeable even of how your muscular system works, the fascia around the muscle, the nervous system. There's eight major nervous systems within eight major systems within our body. And it's each one of them requires a specialist unto itself. So I can see why they would say 100% guaranteed the calf will not injure again, but without knowing.
Well, no, they said that only the calf could injure again. That was the crazy thing. They said, oh, the worst that could happen is the calf would be re-injured.
And that's a muscle guy talking. And he was correct. The, technically, the calf held. What didn't held was
a muscle guy. A muscle guy. I like that. He's a muscle guy.
He's a muscle guy. That's all he knows.
And it's so funny that that's how you're referring to the doctor and not the athlete, because that's how people often refer to athletes. But, you know, I bring all this up because apropos to dial this all back in to this conversation about the eye strain, right? That if we're experiencing things like eye strain and we're just ignoring it because, well, we're doing the things we have to do or think we have to do on a daily basis, what else then might manifest in the wake of our ignoring our discomfort, our dis-ease? And this was the conversation, I guess this is why I'm bringing it up, because what I wanted in the wake of Kevin Durant was instead of Achilles truthers coming out into the mix, which was a big thing, I wanted there to be a conversation about how I think almost every adult and maybe most school children also know what it is to feel pressure, both external and internal, and often it's the pressure we put on ourselves. But pressure, let's just call it that. All of us know the pressure to get back to work. You know, whether that work be a game, a sports game, or school, or our occupation. But we all know the pressure, external and internal, to get back to work when our health or our bodies have been compromised, and we're risking even longer ramifications by doing so. And that's the conversation that we desperately need to have.
Yeah, well, for sure, because they're making these huge salaries. I mean, when you hear, you know, $50, $60, $70 million per year, if you come from a background where there's a work ethic and you're going to feel pressure that you're not going to take that year off and collect a $70 million paycheck and not feel that you should be doing something for that $70 million. So I can see
You want the next paycheck, because then what you're looking at is, yeah, your life's been changed, but if you get the next big payday, then, you know, multi-year contract, now you're talking about generational change. And, yeah. You know, and they, so athletes who are really successful quickly become the CEOs of corporations. It's just that their bodies are the product, and they've got to keep getting that body out into the marketplace. But how different is that than the rest of us who will get to that point of, you know what, I can't afford to fall behind. I can't afford, you know, nobody's going to pay me for the time that I'm missing. Nobody's going to pay me for the triple time it's going to take to catch up, be it in my studies or in my work or, you know, whatever it is. So I think everybody knows this. And I think it's just another manifestation of how fundamentally unhealthy modern life is. But as I say, you know, our culture was not built to promote health. That wasn't what, you know, it maybe could have been, maybe ought to have been, but that's the opportunity now. Is doesn't it all have to start from health? And the interesting thing then, and again, the gift of that keep on giving, that keeps on giving of all these mass shootings is, mental health care is a big part of all this, right?
Right.
How's the only way that anybody is capable of withstanding that pressure, external and internal, to continue to do something unhealthy when they are compromised, putting them at greater risk? How do you withstand those pressures? Well, you've got to have some rigorous mental resources developed to withstand that kind of pressure.
And you're not going to develop that by cruising on Facebook and looking at your phone every half hour. That's going to require, you know,
unless it's to see if my friends in podcasting have posted something.
therein lies the health. A thoughtful conversation.
All right. I want to talk about some things before we continue with my conversation with Chase Masterson, played part one last week. We'll conclude it this week. But Dean, a couple of things. What's going on with Gravity Hole? How many episodes are available?
Well, there's 10 episodes available so far. We're going to record another big batch. And then we are having a big conversation of how and where to launch our live stream through Twitch and what time and should we, you know, do it for the European market, make it daytime in the European market or evening time North American market, that kind of thing.
So this is, again, 20-minute long episodes, improvised, unfolding in real time with a time lock in every episode.
That's correct. A self-destruct mechanism starts the show, and we blow up at the end of it. So you have 20 minutes to get that show in, to say what we have to say, which sometimes is nothing at all. So it's hilarious. It's sci-fi. We're in space. It's all a green screen set. I can do it from Detroit, and Scott's in Los Angeles, and it's the magic of how the future of television is going to be.
And people can find it again. Is it episodes.gravityhole.com? Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, you can see them all there. And then we'll be announcing other extended shows live as the future unfolds.
All right. Now, you had dropped a major pod bomb, let's call it. Is there such a thing, a pod bomb? I don't know.
It sounds good. Yes.
It's the Dean Haglin pod bomb, where you said that you were going back to stand up, but this was actual writing of material, not improv. You're not touring with your improv act, but going back to the old observational stand-up comedy.
Yes, about my life. Because how could you not have 20 minutes after moving from Australia to Michigan? Seriously.
Well, I mean, just Canada to America to Australia to Michigan.
That's true, right?
Yeah. And how? And I love that I refer to Los Angeles as America and Michigan as Michigan.
That's right. The true America is California. What? No.
Well, I'm not even sure that Los Angeles reflects California. That's the other thing. Like, if somebody says that they live in California, do you think they live in Los Angeles? I wouldn't, because I think people say that they live in Los Angeles. Where are you from? I'm from Los Angeles. If you're from anywhere else, I think you're from California. Maybe you specify, and maybe you say I'm from Northern California or, you're, you know, from Southern California. But I don't think you – I really do. I don't think anybody who's from Los Angeles ever travels around and says, oh, I'm from California. They – and they probably don't even say Los Angeles. They say L.A., certainly.
Yeah, they say L.A.
This country.
Yeah, very specific.
So what is going on with that? Have you gotten up in front of the mic yet? When will this take place, and how can people – go and watch.
The exciting thing is that there's many open mics. So starting this week, I'll be at the little place called the Independent, and then I'll be doing an exciting show July 17th. This is really fun. It is similar to Setlist. I don't know if you know Setlist at all. Setlist is a show where the comedian goes on stage and then they project a slide that is technically the topic of his stand-up. And then he improvises some stand-up. This is a similar show, except it's about conspiracy theories. So I am going to attempt to do the unified conspiracy theory of everything in character as a defunct DJ that won't work for the Illuminati anymore. So this will be happening July 17th, Thursday evening in Detroit. I will have more details as they come to me. I just said yes to it just last week. So I'm not even exactly sure where it's happening. I just know the date, and it's going to be at 9 p.m. 9 wow. p.m. July 16th.
Well, we will keep people informed because that sounds like one to see.
Yes.
Speaking of seeing, I'm curious, what television shows have you been watching?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? We have been, oddly enough, on Amazon Prime, we are fascinated, absolutely fascinated, by the reruns of a 1968 comedy series called Laugh-In, where this young Goldie Hawn and other stars performed. And we thought we'd watch one, and now we're hooked on seeing the entire run of this show. It is fascinating how comedy has changed. It is shocking how similar the political situation is in 1968 as it is now. Some of the same jokes would play. The performances, just seeing the talent, it is vastly entertaining and shocking at how not just not funny. It's not funny, but it's how comedy evolves in context. That to me is really fascinating. So I'm watching Laugh-In almost as a scientist.
So, you know, we've talked a lot, and people say this a lot about how this is the golden age of television, you know, starting last decade with the Breaking Bads and the Mad Men's, you know, has really become a golden age. The quality of it, exceeding right. even the quality and, you know, the technical quality even of the making of movies. You know, and we became aware of this, where movies were becoming shockingly not character-driven, but so many shows seem to be, unspooling like great novels. And
right.
But the truth is that as much as we want to paint that brush, that window shut. And it shut with a loud sound like the opening little sting of the Netflix logo. Because how people tend to consume this stuff is through binge watching now.
Right.
And, right. And as we've talked about, as we warned, and our warnings were dire and have come true, for a show to work in binge fashion, it's got to be plot driven.
Right.
And if it's plot driven, you can get the misguided impression that what you're watching is good. But ultimately, unfulfilling, unsatisfying. It will be an expression of cleverness and not an expression of truth, because truth comes from story and story comes from character and from authentic exploration of character. And however, there's another place the truth comes from, and I was really realizing this over the last couple weeks while catching up on season 2 of HBO's Barry and the final season of HBO's Veep, and not only appreciating that these are the two best comedy series of recent time, but they're also the two most truthful shows on television, and
right.
they mine so much truth. And I was really realizing, you know, I was asking myself, why is it that when you're watching television, when you're watching episodics, why is it that truth is conveyed in comedy and not through dramatic episodes? Because again, there are so many acclaimed and well-made and well-acted and thought-provoking dramatic series, but they don't reveal truths the way that these comedy series do. And it's because of this, it's because of the idea that we live in a culture now where the episodes need to be plot driven, even the comedy shows. But if you are taking a comedic approach to it, you are at the same time, if you're geniuses like the people making these shows, you're
right.
commenting on those conventions at the same time that you are following them.
Right.
And that opens the door to satire, and satire reveals truth.
I think that's the thing, right? The Molière version of television, which I think Seinfeld first did, right? When it was a show about nothing, technically it was a farce in tradition of Molière, where, you know, the classic hallway with six doorways and all the characters running across the doorways, slamming, trying to find each other. And then all the doors open at once. Everybody comes out in the hallway and go to black. So that it's not first act, second act, third act. It is a build to a hilarious moment and a blackout. So I think that now is more what I'm seeing when I watch Veep and stuff like that, is that you're going to a farcical nature as opposed to a melodramatic nature that some sitcoms try to do, where there's, you know, a misunderstanding, hilarious second act, and then everybody, oh, Bob wasn't dead. I just heard his car was dead. You know, whatever. However, those cheesy 90s sitcoms all ended back then. So I got to think that we all learned a lesson from switching from melodrama to farcical.
So even like a decade ago, think about when we were talking about satire that revealed truth. We were talking about The Daily Show. We were talking about The Colbert Report, right?
Right.
And these were comedy shows that hewed close to the conventions of news programs. And it was always wrong to me when people would just color it firstly and foremostly as political comedy, because right. The targets were more directly how and intrinsically how the media covers political
yes.
stories, and then how political figures would use or be used by that media. And so its target was about this giant technology that was able to not manipulate the truth, but often avoid the truth altogether. And right. revealing that the way we depict things and talk about things avoids complicated truths revealed a truth. And it was a truth that was funny, and it was a truth that was felt empowering and inspiring. And it got people involved in a way that news shows did not. And I feel like now here we are 10 years later, and we've got, like I said, shows like Barry, shows like Veep that are doing that in a scripted, character-based setting, and they ring so true. They're revealing such truths about life. Often by taking on the conventions of storytelling itself, and so it's a really, really interesting time. And I'm gonna be on the lookout for more comedy shows that I think do this. But it wasn't a thesis that I set out to prove. It was right. something that just kind of I went, wow, there are dramas I love. I mean, there are episodic yeah. drama shows that I love, but. Boy,
well, for me, Barry's not funny. Barry is so grippingly true that it's almost painful. And same with Veep. Sometimes it's not cringe comedy. I just fall into the depths of despair watching Veep, because it's like, as funny as the quips are and the comebacks and all that, the unmitigating bureaucracy and backstabbing and whatever is so. Prevalent.
I feel like with Barry, a lot of the times you're right. I mean, there might be. There's funny things that go on, and the characters, the actors are doing funny things often. But it's more the a la dark comedy. It's the fact that someone's making this commentary
right.
that is so delightful that has me laughing. Just the balls of it. A la, in some ways, Tarantino, in some ways, The Ladykillers, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's where the truth comes from in The Ladykillers, because let's not kid ourselves. The Ladykillers is plot-driven. It isn't character-driven. It flies in the face of all I believe about storytelling, except
yeah, right.
that was the target, was to take on these conventions.
Right.
And so therein lies the approach of satire.
Fantastic.
We will not go into the Chilpak morgue this week, because we want to get to part two of this interview. And plus, we were Plus, we did a great job of opening up the Chilpac Osteopathic Clinic earlier in the show.
So yeah, so we're covering it. We're getting it covered.
But it's a nutty time at the box office, at the U.S. box office, in that those sounds you're hearing are just gigantic implosions where movie theaters are dropping in to pits in the earth, never to return. That's what it feels like when you look at these numbers. I mean, whether it's franchise fatigue, sequelitis, or just a bunch of shitty movies, I don't know. But you have, but I don't think it's just the fact that it's shitty movies, because you have smart female-driven movies that everybody says that they want that, oh, by the way, are funny, like Late Night with Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling, and Booksmart, which I talked about, which is so great, doing no business at all. And then meanwhile, you've got sequels like Godzilla, Secret Life of Pets, Men in Black International, Shaft, Dark Phoenix, and these movies aren't even opening. I mean, collectively, they're going to lose billions of dollars. And so, you know, where are we at? So let's set the table for future discussion about that. We're not going to leave the world of needing to build franchises, but in a post-Fox Disney merger, what does it mean for these companies to build franchises, to maintain franchises, and how can they look at, on the big end, what Marvel did, and on the smaller end, what a John Wick franchise has done? And and may I say, going back through the years, what a James Bond franchise did, because there's some similarities between all three of those examples that I think studios would be well advised to learn from. So we'll maybe attack that next week. I do want to say, apropos of Marvel, that Captain Marvel came out on home video this week, and I'd been kind of waiting to talk about it because it took me a while to catch this. This is it's the best of times and the worst of times. It's the worst of times because the first 20-30 minutes are as bad as any superhero movie ever.
Right.
Then it gets to Earth and it becomes so funny, and it's the best of times. It's as funny as these superhero movies
really
get. It's from the writing directing team of Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, and these people made a handful of superb independent films through the years, including Half Nelson, starring Ryan Gosling. Such good movies, but again, best of times, worst of times. Great that these people are able to apply their talents. Worst of times that it was years since they've been able to make a movie, and all that they get to make is a fucking superhero movie. Because we need people like this making their movies.
Right.
But it's I found it so refreshing, especially in the wake of Avengers Endgame 4, which offered me nary a moment of delight at all. And though it's probably a better movie, but Captain Marvel, which is a movie replete with weaknesses, is jam-packed full of delights.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm shocked to hear that. So this is Shazam.
Not Shazam. This is Captain Marvel.
This is Captain Marvel. And so, but Shazam
is DC's Captain Marvel.
Right. And that one was also filled with delights, apparently.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. But that's the little boy who says Shazam and becomes a grown-up superhero. Captain Marvel is, of course, Carol Danvers, the you know, the female fighter pilot who becomes a superhero. And that's the one I'm talking about.
I
tend not to truck with the DC universe, as you know, because
what's wrong with you?
Well, because in the movies, you know. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, 500 times. Go fuck yourself. Is how I feel about the DC universe.
Well, I don't know if that's t-shirt worthy, but sure.
hit quick hits on two other films. One film that I went to see that opened yesterday that's quite divisive among critics, and I imagine among audiences, and people are surprised that it's divisive, though it's directed and written by Jim Jarmusch, and why you would go to any Jim Jarmusch movie and expect anything other than a Jim Jarmusch movie, I don't know. But it's the zombie comedy boasting the greatest cast ever disassembled. It's The Dead Don't Die.
Oh, yeah.
And, boy, I was laughing a lot during movie. It is, like every Jim Jarmusch movie, a meditation. Even when he goes to genre pieces like Westerns, like Dead Man, or Hitman movies like Ghost Dog Way of the Samurai, or vampire films like The Only Lovers Left Alive, even when he drops into genre material, it's still a Jim Jarmusch meditation. It plays like you are entering a meditation. And... But the deadpan approach that is taken to this material, I find so funny. And and the fact that Jim Jarmusch and his cast don't, they take the zombie genre for the ridiculousness that it is, but they double down one step further, which is they take the social satire element that is replete within the best of zombie films, and they find that ridiculous.
Wow. Wow. Now I really want to see this.
And so I can understand why it actually made a lot of people angry and why it upsets a lot of people. And but people who think, oh, well, it's slow moving, or, oh, well, you know, it's like, it is a Jim Jarmusch movie. I mean, you know, why did you go expecting, you know, a Tarantino or a Sam Raimi film?
Right.
They're not hiding who directed it. But it's really a wonderful approach, and actually, it's such a great expression to me of kind of Jim Jarmusch's cynical side of himself. Because what better genre for him to be working in than one where the main characters are literally shuffling along as slowly as possible?
Wow. So they're not the fast running 28 days.
No.
No. They're the slow, shuffly ones.
And the comedy pairing of Bill Murray and Adam Driver as the sheriff and his main deputy in this town. Dear God. Dear God. That's worth the price of admission alone. Finally, Dean, in your wheelhouse, I'm dying to ask you about this because, you know, I continue to try to... fill in my education where silent films are concerned.
Yes.
I watched a beautiful movie and a hugely influential movie, The Phantom Carriage.
Oh, yeah.
From Sweden, 1921. I had recorded it, the Criterion Collection edition of it, I had recorded a long time ago, and finally... watched it late at night in a darkened environment so that I could see it as much as possible. I mean, this movie, wow, holy shit, this was influential. I mean, I'm watching it going, oh, well, boy, Ingmar Bergman sure took a lot from this. And of course he did. He, you know, what is it, 36 years later, he makes two movies, one of which kind of borrows the plot, Seventh Seal, where you know somebody's trying to play a game of chess to outwit death. But that same year, he makes Wild Strawberries, which stars the director, writer, star of The Phantom Carriage.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Victor Seastrom, who apparently was his idol. And I'm struck by, oh my goodness, here's that name again. This movie's a huge influence on David Lynch, for crying out loud. There's actual shots that he's recreating in his work.
Ripping off? Stealing?
Recreating.
Yeah. Okay, you call it recreating. Yes, recreating. David Lynch recreates. I know. Well, that's the thing. You know, are we getting into David Lynch argument again?
No. But I was just thinking about thoughts about Phantom Carriage, because this is the exciting thing for me. I mean, we're talking about it, 1921. It's almost 100 years old. And what a wonderful amount of material there is that I think is an untapped resource for people who want to be storytellers today. There's nothing wrong with going back and saying, oh my goodness, I want to recreate this. I want to recreate this moment. I want to recreate this. Because look, you're not going to be making a silent film in Sweden about the Salvation Army movement. Right? You're not going to be. So it's not like you're out and out stealing. But what still resonates, it's like, well, why does this resonate? Oh, what can I take from this and bring in today? Because there's some reason that it's still affecting me and haunting me right now, even though it's a foreign country, it's a silent film, it's 100 years ago, and yet it's still affecting me.
Right. Yes. Because those images are haunting, and because the absolute, you know, the graphic grandeur of it all is what silent film had. Oh, wait.
What?
My Doberman's running at the door.
Oh, my goodness. My cat has been kind of sniffing my knee the whole show, and she just got up and ran towards the door. So
oh
I think,
gosh,
a la the Phantom Carriage, one of us is being visited by death. So we'll find out on next week's show which one of us is driving the carriage. And now, we leave you with part two of my conversation with Chase Masterson. Dean tells this story about how his mother used to say to him, you know, you might, son, you might be more successful if you focused on just one thing. Mm. Have you ever had that feeling? Because you have, again, you've had all these accomplishments in these disparate professions, these, you know, linked, simpatico, but still distinct professions, occupations. Have you ever felt?
Yes, definitely. Particularly with so much of my energy and time and heart going into the coalition and not into the work that I've been, you know, that I make a living at. I don't make any money on the coalition. Speaking of, it's Pop Culture Hero Coalition,
yes,
which I founded. And so Pop Culture Hero Coalition is the first ever organization to use stories from TV, film, and comics to actively work against bullying, racism, misogyny, LGBTQI plus bullying, and cyberbullying in schools, and also to create programming for the same in Comic-Cons. And we also have a program in children's hospitals. And I founded the organization with an incredible bullying prevention expert named Carrie Goldman in 2013. And it's possible for me to work 12 hours a day on it. There's a huge amount that we've done and are doing, but we are still not funded to hire a team. And I'm not at the place I can do that much longer, but I don't mind because the work is working. And we're doing incredible things, and people say we're saving lives. And yet I know that if I focused on getting work, I would get more
right.
of it.
And right.
that it just is what it is. But I also don't want to give up this very unique opportunity we have to change lives and save
right.
lives in a very direct way, which I know that theater and film does, and music does. But this is another way to do it, and it's important.
I finally got to this point where I realized that what I want is to engage with people in conversation, that's really what it is. And maybe it's a conversation like this, and maybe it's a conversation that a film starts.
Mm.
But, you know, Dean and I used to get these questions when we would travel, and somebody once asked, now, do you do the podcast to promote your movies, or do you do your movies to promote your podcast?
That's funny.
And I loved the assumption that promotion had to be part of it.
Yeah.
They just couldn't figure out
right.
which.
You've been doing this podcast a long time,
12,
though, haven't you?
12 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
Yeah. You go to a lot of different conventions, and the Hero Coalition has a major presence now at these. And what are those experiences like?
It's pretty amazing. We'll do these conventions that, we have convention panels that are packed with hundreds of people. And sometimes there's just about You know, sometimes there's a lot less, but sometimes there's hundreds of people. And my co-founder, Carrie Goldman, is just, she's brilliant, an amazing heart. And one of the things she'll ask, I mean, not that this is brilliant to ask, but she is anyway, but I digress. She'll say, how many of you people here were bullied 5 years ago? How about 10? How about 15? 20, 25, 30? And the hands are still up. People in their 80s have come to our panel to talk about being bullied in grade school. Mm. And we realize, I mean, we already know this, but we also re-realize how lasting the pain can be, how hurtful and in a negatively transforming way it can be, and how important it is for us to, and I mean us, all of us in society, to stand up for people and let people know that we value who they are. Yes. And that it was wrong for them to ever be bullied. And if they were bullied, it was not about them. And that's so key. I mean, it's the hardest thing to assimilate, you know, or to right. absorb. But right. if you were bullied, it was never about you. It is right. always about the bully, of the lack of kindness, the lack of compassion or empathy, and the lack of self-esteem and self, and the lack of identity that the other person has.
Right. Well, a lack of self-control. We seek to control other people when we have no control over our own feelings, our own
impulses. It is self-control, but you know, to have to control, this is not about like control about being politically correct right. or anything, of course,
right.
as you know.
Right.
This is about having
The bullying impulse is I have no control over my own impulses, my own feelings, so I seek
right.
that feeling by controlling other people.
Right. And what we want to do is create a fire of empathy in people and in the work we do in schools and children, where they can grow up knowing that it's fun to have empathy. It's fun to support and promote each other's
it's heroic.
Right to be whoever they want to be. Exactly.
That's what's so interesting about this coalition of heroes. You know, I always liked the phrase compassionate warrior.
Beautiful.
You know, a warrior whose chief tool is compassion.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I like this. You know, this.
It's what we all want, and so it's what we all need to give. You know, there are so many people that judge. You know, bullies judge who other people are, and yet all of us need to keep in mind that, I'm just saying this for different reasons. You know, we've got a program going into schools called HEROIC, Healing, Empathy, and Resilience for Orthopedically Impaired Children.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's run by a man named Scott Palm, who has cerebral palsy. He's completely paralyzed except for the use of one hand. It's actually one finger on one hand that uses a communication device.
Whoa.
To speak like Stephen Hawking. And I met him at a Star Trek convention in 2013. And the way we met is I passed him in the hallway and I said, "What's that?" And it's this computer thing on a wheelchair. And he, laboriously, as Scott does, pecked out this thing that says, "It's my communication device," in this voice like Stephen Hawking's,
right,
which he
right.
chose.
Yeah.
And so we've been friends ever since. And Scott is, once I got to know him further, he's an incredible advocate in the state of Washington for people with disabilities. And he teaches people to give care to people with disabilities. Well, this is going back to people like Scott are made fun of.
Mm-hmm.
They are, you know, they are. Often in schools, there's still incredible marginalization. As much as any of us feel marginalized,
mm-hmm.
how much more do kids in wheelchairs or kids who can't speak or, you know, but my point is any one of us could have been any of them.
Yes.
You know, if there's a kid who's overweight in school, you have no idea why, and it doesn't matter why, and you could have been that kid, so shut up. And that's not actually what we preach, but what we say, what we would not even preach, is what we have is a 32-lesson plan curriculum that's going into schools, created by psychologists to use heroes we love on screen to teach inclusion.
Yes.
And to teach empathy and to teach us to see each other for who we are as human.
Well, and, you know, what you were saying is, you know, any one of us could have been this person.
Yeah. We could have been Scott.
The big eye-opener for me when I started to explore and study violence and bullying behavior and was the moment where I realized, you know, there is no other. And,
yeah.
Oh my goodness, I, there but for the grace of God go I in terms of the perpetrators,
yeah.
That I was fortunate enough to, however it happened, learn healthier tools,
yes.
When I was young.
Yeah, yeah.
And these people didn't.
Right.
And so again, that doesn't excuse them and their behavior, but it underscores it's about education. It's about getting to people when they're young and giving them the opportunity to learn healthier.
Yeah.
Ways to live.
Exactly. And helping them understand and develop a healthy identity and helping them deal with their own wounds.
Yes.
We have a saying, hurt, and you've probably heard it before, hurt people,
right.
And healed people, heal people.
Yeah.
Chances are the bully who hurt you, whoever, was hurt horrifically.
Yeah.
People only give what they have to give. So we get at this from a really holistic, multi-platform level. And the programs that my team does, these programs work with everyone in the community that's involved. So Carrie's book is called Bullied, What Every Parent, Teacher, and Kid Needs to Know About Ending the Cycle of Fear.
Mm.
And it was published by HarperCollins, and it's won a lot of awards. And Carrie now speaks on every major news channel, and she's interviewed regularly and keynote speaks across the country, and she does incredible work. And part of that is dealing with the bullies and why do they have this aggression? What's going on at their homes?
Right.
And then when the child bullies, you know, and so helping them to heal of whatever it is that's driving them. And when, you know, there's restorative justice. So when a child is bullied and they're going to have to go through the rest of the year, or God forbid, 12 years, with the bully, we get to a place where we can incorporate the whole community, parents on both sides, if there are parents, you know, whatever, and the school, the administrators, the teachers, and really create a culture of kindness. And that's what we need to do in this country, damn it.
Well, you said incorporate the community. I would say you're doing nothing less than trying to rebuild the community, because I think a lot of it is the sore lack of community, the fragmentation of community.
Yeah, yeah. The otherizing of each other.
Yes. So, speaking of community, which has become a theme that has emerged here in our conversation going back to 5 years old,
right.
And a theater community.
Yeah, yeah.
You find yourself a part of the Star Trek community.
Mm. Yeah.
Both the fans, which is a community, and the universe of creators and performers.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to me. Of course you had to be a part of it, because it really is this creative community.
Yeah.
And I've always thought of it, interestingly enough, certainly Deep Space Nine and The Next Generation and maybe even Voyager, as almost theater troops too.
Yeah.
Because I always thought, like, well, wouldn't it be fascinating, this group of performers getting to go on the road and put on lots of different shows. Like each night it's a different play, because it's this wonderful company of actors.
Right. Right, right.
That had developed that kind of rapport,
yes.
With each other. And because it's Star Trek, because it allows for time travel and holosuites, you literally could have this week we're doing Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, this is a Renaissance scene.
So,
this is a...
So it's a, even within that, in terms of the amount, the kind of stories that could be told, it's a different kind of community from most creative communities in television.
Yeah. There's a lot of creativity
and film. And then you add the conventions. So how have the members of that creative community supported you with this coalition community?
Well, thank you for asking. So our cast and members of many of the other casts have helped us to raise money for the programs that we're putting together. We have these Be Kind t-shirts, and they just say Be Kind with a heart on the front, and then our name and logo. It's actually our name and social media handle, which is at Superhero IRL for Superhero in Real Life. It's on the back, and they're very simple, and they're actually how we've raised the bulk of our money for our programs. It's very difficult to get grants as an educational nonprofit for to create a curriculum. They will pay you to, oftentimes you can get money to research a created curriculum or to distribute, but to create it, that you have to have more proof than just, hey, I've got a great idea. In education.
Right.
So this is how we've raised the money, $25 at a time with these Be Kind shirts. So many members of our cast, in fact, all of them at one particular convention, Armin, Max, who I adore, Nana, Terry, Jeffrey, and Casey, and I, and Ira, all wore these Be Kind shirts in a photo, and so we have those for sale. We have done other fundraisers, but the primary way has been selling t-shirts, and that's really noteworthy because it really is crowdsourced empathy.
Right.
It's kind of better than a $10,000 grant if X number of people, 400 people, buy a $25 t-shirt. Then now we're talking of... It's the message. It's
the message is already getting
out to the community, and it's money that's creating a program that will last.
Guests of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.